Desmond Cormier's success story was an improbable one, even among the many self-congratulatory rags-to-riches tales we tell ourselves in the ongoing saga of our Green Republic, one that is forever changing yet forever the same, a saga that also includes the graves of Shiloh and cinders from Aboriginal villages. That is not meant to be a cynical statement. Desmond's story was a piece of Americana, assuring us that wealth and a magical kingdom are available to the least of us, provided we do not awaken our own penchant for breaking our heroes on a medieval wheel and revising them later safely downwind from history. Desmond was not only born to privation in the sleeper of a semi in which his mother tied off the umbilical cord and said goodbye forever. He was nurtured by his impoverished grandparents on the Chittimacha Indian Reservation in the back room of a general store that was hardly more than an airless shack. It stood on a dirt road amid treeless farmland where shade and a cold soda pop on the store gallery were considered luxuries, before the casino operators from Jersey arrived and, with the help of the state of Louisiana, convinced large numbers of people that a vice is a virtue. Like his grandparents, he belonged to that group of mixed-blood Indians unkindly called Red Bones. His hair was cinnamon-colored, more a characteristic of Cajun women than of men. His skin was as smooth as clay, almost hairless. His eyes a washed-out blue and set too wide like those of someone with fetal alcohol syndrome. He was self-conscious about his racial background, as most of his people were, and smiled rarely, but when he did, he could light a room. I always had the sense that Desmond was trying to shrink inside his clothes, as though both fear and a great sadness lived inside him. Like Proteus blowing his wreathed horn, Desmond constantly created and recreated himself, perhaps never knowing who he was. No matter. Even as a little boy, he was not one to accept the world as it was, no more than he would accept the hand he'd been dealt. By the time he was 12, he seemed destined to remain skinny and frail and a carrier of intestinal worms and head lice. One morning, behind his grandparents' general store, bare-chested under a white sun, his little body running with sweat, he roped a cinder block to each end of a broom handle and lifted, and kept lifting, and squeezing a rubber ball silently on the school bus while the bigger boys laughed at him and often pushed him down on the gravel. By the time he was 14, he had the body and the latent animus of a man, and the boys who had bullied him now tried to ingratiate themselves with a weak, self-deprecating smile. He responded with the benign attention of someone watching a stranger blow soap bubbles until they bowed their heads and went silent, lest they provoke him. After high school, he waited tables in the French Quarter and became an apprentice to a sidewalk artist in Jackson Square and discovered that he was better than his teacher. Sometimes I would see him in the early a.m., disheveled, paint on his shirt and in his hair, eating beignets out of a paper bag and drinking café au lait from a styrofoam cup. On a particularly cold and gray January morning, I saw him hunched on an iron bench inside the fog by St. Louis Cathedral, like an unevolved creature from an earlier time. He was not wearing a coat, and his sleeves were rolled high up on his arms as though in defiance of the weather. He seemed melancholy, his insouciance a pretense for his loneliness, and I sat down beside him without being invited. The air smelled of the river, dead beetles in a storm sewer, the wine and beer cups in the gutters, damp soil and night-blooming flowers and lichen on stone. It was a smell like a Caribbean city rather than America. He told me he was going to Hollywood so he could become a film director. "Don't you have to study to do that?" I said. "I already have," he replied. "Where?" He pointed a finger to his head. "In here." I grinned good-naturedly but didn't speak. "Don't believe me, huh?" he said. "What do I know?" "You still go to mass?" he said. "Sure." "That means you believe in the things that are on the other side of the physical world. That's what painting is. That's what making movies is. You enter a magical world others have no knowledge of. I got up from the bench. I felt old. My war wounds ached. The hardness of the bench was printed on my buttocks. I heard the Angelus ringing in the cathedral's tower, perhaps as a reminder of our mutability and ultimate fate. Good luck, I said. Kick some butt in California. There was a smear of powdered sugar on his cheek. For just a moment I thought of a pauper child who might have ferreted his way into a bakery. He was smiling when he looked up at me. What's the joke? I asked. Anything you get with luck isn't worth owning, Dave. I thought you knew that.